Well, welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Steve Kinnane. How are you?
Thanks very much for having me. Good, thank you. It's cold, but good.
It is. And here's something, though, to warm the cockles of one's heart, a book called Shadow Lines that you're the author of, Steve. This was published way back. First published?
2003. In late 2003,
and it's published by Fremantle Press, and I'm guessing there must have been, just from reading it, you know that there was quite a long lead time in researching it, travelling here and there, writing it, rewriting it, no doubt editing it.
Yep.
How long did it take to put this mammoth, gigantic, heartfelt story together?
I think, how long did it take? It started really as a project. I was working with the writer Lauren Marsh, and we were doing research into a range of different stories, doing a lot of oral histories back since 1988 up in Kununurra and elsewhere. And over the course of time, we started looking at removal stories, and in particular focused on women's stories. And my grandmother's story was one of those that we were looking at, but it was broader than that. And we set out to create an anthology of women's stories. And it was really from that that Shadow Lines came. But along the way also came, because we were talking to people like Mrs. Alice Nanup, who was, you know, very keen to have her own book. And so this book got put aside while we focused on Nan's book, When the Pelican Laughed, which was published by Fremantle Arts Centre Press. And soon after that, the Coolbaroo Club ABC TV documentary, a lot of the people we'd interviewed had spoken very glowingly of the Coolbaroo Club. And so the documentary became the focus for 3 years. And in between that, all the other things in between that you do. But Shadow Lines kept being worked on in between. You know, I'd have fits and starts and time here and there. And we spent hours and hours and hours in the archives, as well as doing regular trips throughout the country, going back to country, living in the Kimberley periodically between heading around the wheat belt, the Pilbara, wherever people who were a part of my grandparents' life had lived. Basically, growing up, I'd heard all of these amazing stories through my mother and aunties and uncles, and there were a lot of characters who I hadn't known, so I went in search of them. And in that sense, while I'm down as the author of the book, it's very much a work of myself and Lauren Marsh to research. But I think it's really down to the stories of those people who we then spoke to. And I hope that their voices come through really clearly.
Steve, using Mirrawong language, I'm a Kaurna and I come to the book and read the story that way. Of course, it's got a Kaurna side of it because it also tells a story about your grandfather coming from the UK and then a marriage between the two of them and a whole life that comes out of it. But for a Kaurna reading this, it just tells you so many things that you don't know about how Aboriginal people found themselves living in the metropolitan area of Perth. It's more than history. It's a lived story that you so beautifully portray. When you think back on it, the book having just had some minor corrections made and reissued by Fremantle Press just now, how do you respond to your own work? Do you look at it and think, oh, that's something I've finished and done? You pick it up and...
No. Look, it's really wonderful that the press have republished or reprinted Shadow Lines. It's funny how almost any stories that we become engaged with, particularly community stories and stories that have such a wonderful collection of voices such as this, like with all of our lives, things have a way of cycling back. So Shadow Lines has, while it's only just been reprinted, it's also influenced a number of other productions. It's led to people finding their children who were taken away, or their grandchildren, or people who didn't know who their family were, you know, reading it and making contact and us putting them in touch with people. So it's kind of had its own interesting ongoing living life, I suppose, as a story that reaches people. So in that sense, it's wonderful that it's being reprinted. It's really nice that there's a new audience that's coming to it. But it's kind of bubbled away. So in that sense, it hasn't necessarily felt like it went away. But I think when you write anything, particularly something like this that has so many other people's voices in it, you're never really completely disconnected from that. So I still have regular contact with grandchildren of people who whose voices are in the book. Just recently there was, actually while I was in Canada, I caught up with a countryman who was from Gidja country, met him and his wife at the Lauren Culture Festival a few years back when I was in Canada, we caught up. And I was able to share images of his grandmother who'd been, his auntie and other women who'd been at my grandmother's house but had been taken away. There's just those funny resonances that occur consistently. So in that sense, it feels that it is a long, it doesn't feel like it's 17 years ago. But I think the nice thing is it appears to have held its narrative. It's held its relevance. It doesn't feel like it's trapped in the past, which I think is good.
Well, I can confirm that that's my reaction to it. The praise for Shadow Lines that appears at the very front of the book, for example, from the Age newspaper at the time, beautifully written. Shadowland is a powerful, deeply personal and inspiring story of love and the ability of a human spirit to triumph despite overwhelming odds is, in my view, dead right. And it's reflected in so many other reviews. And it does hold true to me today from my experiences. Early on in the book, you talk about going to the Kimberleys, the East Kimberleys, and recognising that your grandmother is a Mirrawong person from up or down. I've forgotten which direction south is. It's probably up when you're in Kununurra, from Mirrawong country, from the old Argyle station area. And you realise that you, in a sense, have to sit on the outer of the ring and wait to be invited in and learn more about things. How much did you grow up knowing about those connections through your grandmother? And how much did you learn and quickly afterwards?
Well, I think we, people like my grandmother, created our own community down here. So there's the community of Nor'westers, we used to call ourselves, which encompassed anyone from basically Carnarvon up. So we were Northeast. And I think a way of surviving removals was that people shared as much as they could about where they were from, their background, and then that linked them in ways kind of like an extended family network down here. So in that sense, I've been raised within that environment, which was very much an impact of colonialism, the settlement system, mission experience. But also I hope what Shadowline shows is the way in which people responded positively to those ruptures by creating a new community. So when I went back, it wasn't that I was searching for an identity per se or wanting to crash into what is a very strong, cultural, vibrant community in Mirrawong country, but I just wanted to be sure that our links were respected and, as you say, to listen. So in that sense, it was, as a young fella at the time, at age 20, 19 heading up and 20 living up there and around 21, 22, and then going back periodically and still going back this year regularly. I feel connected. It was really wonderful to make that re-establishment of that connection. Learning things was, women in particular, but also many of the older men were really keen to impart knowledge. I think so many people have been taken away that when people came back, there was just such a strong sense of embrace. as well as caution, as in people like myself didn't know about avoidance relationships and we didn't know proper language words for country. So you're in a way, you're an empty vessel that needs to be taught, like a small child. And I remember sitting with an old woman who's passed away a long time now, Mary Yundaban, out at Yarrangul Springs, Dingo Springs. And she was like literally sitting down and teaching me language nerd words for my nose and for my eyes and my ears and my mouth.
It's
things like that.
So, part of the book, that story, I was sitting there knowing Dingo Springs and thinking about how that was working. That really quite a beautiful scene you painted.
Yeah, and I think if there's anything that I've tried to do is let story speak for itself, let those interactions speak for themselves. So when I went back just recently, I caught up with Uncle David Neary, who is one of the key people who helped me, if you like, when I first went back. You know, he kind of acted as a bit of a broker, at the time, trying to work out what the tracks were, and there were lots of people who'd been removed. So initially we were doing like searching through the archives to establish that link, and that helped because it helped set dates and help us pinpoint possible connections.
Yes.
But ultimately it's really relational. It's ultimately about relationships. And so those we're reconnected and I've continued them in the most honest and integrous way I can. Lived in the Kimberley, always make my way back east, but at the same point, East Kimberley and particularly Mirong, Gadjerong now have native title rights. And so people like myself aren't participating in that because we haven't been through law. We're family, but we're not traditional owners per se. Yes. And that's okay.
So much seems to be happening, but we all know there's so much that has to be done in relation to the rights of Indigenous peoples in Australia. The from the heart propositions seem to be struggling if moving a lot at the moment. There's been a closing the gap rethink recently, and quite a bit of comment about whether it's a new start, a good start, whatever start it is. But a couple of questions really that I wanted to phrase with that sort of introduction. It seems to me that a book like yours ought to be on the curriculum in high schools for 15 and 16 year olds and 17 year olds to read. Has that ever happened? Is there anything the equivalent, if not this book, used for those purposes in schools to try and educate so many people? I mean, all of the killings at the frontiers has been the subject of a lot of discussion and academic work, and The Guardian's been running the series and so on. But what's happening in terms of education of young non-Indigenous Australians about Indigenous matters in the past and the present?
Yeah, Shadow Lines has found its way into different curriculum, not necessarily, usually at university level, sometimes in high schools. It's been very much different schools or teachers' choices, so it's found itself sometimes in that role. There's so many good books and wonderful stories, you know, Kim Scott's work, Sally Morgan's work certainly made it onto the curriculum. We've seen the work of Tara June Winch, who recently won the Miles Franklin Award in New South Wales on their curriculum. So there are a lot of Aboriginal Dark Emu, of course, and Young Dark Emu have made it onto the curriculum. So I think the main thing is that there is so much. It'd be wonderful to see people experience that diversity of stories. And I think, we, with regard to the statement from the heart, one of the key, I suppose, recommendations is the notion of truth-telling, of a truth-telling commission. And we've recently heard that with Mick Dodson come out with regard to work that he's been doing around Treaty Commission in the Northern Territory and elsewhere. The issue of truth-telling is central. And so in that sense, I think books like Shadow Lines, work that King Scott has done here in WA, other non-Indigenous authors like Anna Habick, Marianne Jebb, Chris Owen, Bruce Shaw and his wonderful work in the East Kimberley. I mean, there's a wonderful accumulation of story there. And having taught at university, at particularly undergraduate level, and seeing the way in which students come to this often with very little information from high school, but the way in which engaging with these stories really opens up their world and gets them asking really valuable questions. I'd love to see more exposure for non-Indigenous audiences, and I think we're seeing that. I think when I think back to when Shadowlands was first started as a book in the early 1990s, Mugabala was producing books. I'm a director of Mugabala, and we're really proud of everything we do. There were very few Aboriginal texts at the time. So in the last good, 30 years, we've seen a proliferation of Aboriginal story, and I think that's only for the better. But it'd be nice to see, we do have a curriculum, a national curriculum. It does recommend Indigenous narratives and voices and texts and Indigenous knowledge around caring for country, understanding cultural heritage. I think with teachers, it's often a bit of a struggle because they're unsure often where to start, but there are a lot of good resources for them. And Reconciliation Australia would be one place where, they give resources to teachers too. So in that sense, it's the opportunities are there. At some schools, they've really embraced this incredibly seriously. And in other schools, they're interested, but they're not quite sure how to engage. So I think we're at that precipice of the next generation having far more access.
And that really leads in, I think, to that sort of next question about the next generation. Where do you see all of these things going? You've talked about the early 90s and what there was without us rehearsing the state of politics and native title non-existent until 1992 and the like. How do you perceive where we're going at the moment? Questions of sovereignty don't go away, for example. There's a lot of talk about Aboriginal languages being learned. I'm not talking just about Indigenous people themselves, but more generally in the community. I live in Fremantle, and there are Noongar language courses available, and people seem to be, at least the people who are interested in them, but seem to be growing and are very positive.
Yeah, I think absolutely. There's been a wonderful resurgence of language, even though we still have, a majority of languages are endangered. There's just not enough resources put to language preservation. Groups such as the Kimberley Language Resource Centre don't get enough funding. But we are certainly seeing, Noongar have been amazing in resurgence of Noongar language, people like Len Collard and what they've been doing, the Noongar Language Centre. So I think that in terms of where do I see it going?
Are there trends?
There are lots of... Beg your pardon?
Are there trends? Are there... If you're trying to foresee the future, do you see things that...
Yeah, and I think...
At the moment.
And including native title, I think what you're seeing is there's been a rise of people through prescribed body corporates as well, becoming more and more a part of the fabric of governance, even though they're not funded and they have to kind of make their way best they can through Indigenous land use agreements. We are seeing a greater sense of that governance being respected across a range of fronts. I think with the statement from the heart, something that clearly came from it was a need for regions to have a stronger voice. So we're certainly seeing places like the Kimberley, the southwest of the Singanoongar claim. We can see it in the Murchison through WIMAC. So all the work that's gone into things such as native title may not at this point have realised the promise that people had hoped, but people are using those foundations to create regional voices, regional economies, regional cultural centres to set their own agenda. And through doing that, to be able to produce new things, to actually have a much greater hand on the direction that it does go in. Now, there's always three steps forward, two steps back. I think part of the strength of the statement from the heart when it first came out, and having been someone who'd been engaged in, Aboriginal governance and politics in the Kimberley in particular, but was the way in which things had become through things such as closing the gap, as well-intentioned as they are. And sadly, I think through the mainstreaming of much of Aboriginal service delivery, particularly from the Howard years from 1996 through to about 2007, But that has been continued. We've seen a bit of an erosion of the, if you like, the focus on self-determination and all of the value that comes from being a self-determining people. You know, as you know, within Mirong country, that it comes down to dawangs and clan groups. That goes back to family groups and the right people being able to speak for the right country, you know, in the right way. So that's all there bubbling under the surface, but ultimately where it's leading to is ideally stronger regional voices, but it doesn't then become, if you like, mainstreamed or captured in some sort of a national body that is too distant from the ground. So if anything, I think where it's going in the future is that any kind of decision-making, education programs, choices about culture, are ideally getting closer to the ground, which is where they belong. So that people who are interested in the culture of a particular area can talk to the holders of that knowledge in their area instead of experts or only through books or only through more distant means. So I think it's heading in that direction. It's just that these things are difficult to fund. They require a lot of effort to stay close to the ground and be relevant for people. There's so many good stories of where that's happening, and in the Kimberley I could give you lots of examples too.
Steve, we'll slowly but surely bring this interesting discussion to a close. But in terms of your own work, are we going to see something that could never quite mirror this, because you couldn't do this again? You can't write about this wonderful woman twice. But in terms of a book that is nearly a novel, even though it's a history, a social history, a political history, a very personal account, do you have space to write something that matches it again?
I'm working on something at the moment that's focused on the last 30 years of, if you like, action within the Kimberley around the notion of beyond the land of promises. There was a statement that actually came out from a Mirong woman in 1990 at the Crocodile Hole meeting, the major gathering of traditional owners across the Kimberley. And every meeting I go to still, young people and old people will say, it all goes back to Croc Hole. So I've been working on something which is interviewing people sort of going, well, does it? Are we? What did we achieve? What didn't we achieve? What didn't we think? What was on the horizon that we didn't foresee, such as youth suicide, such as alcohol and its impact? So I've been working on that. Don't get as much time. I've been working with the new museum project as well, which is coming to fruition in November with the curator Michelle Bruin on the Nullarbor Woodja Bruin Gallery. So I'm always busy doing different projects. But in terms of a major book, probably Beyond the Land of Promises is next. But there've been, you know, various smaller projects in the background that I keep tapping away at in the garden shed.
I know you're not unbusy. Well, look, it's been lovely talking to you, and it really is timely that the reprint, as you correctly put it, of Shadow Lines is just completed, and it'd be really lovely if a new generation of people can read what really is a timeless story. It's very beautiful, and congratulations, 17 years after its original release, for talking to me again today about it.
Well, thank you, and thanks for the kind words, and really pleased to participate. Thanks.
I'll just end our conversation